Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Thank all of you again for returning to our seminar on Vedic philosophy, the theme of which is substance and shadow. So today we've moved here only because unexpectedly the ladies who keep this place in order, they spread fresh cow dung over the other site. So it's not very nice to sit on right now. But tomorrow we'll meet on that side again. So today I wanted to discuss about Anuman, which means our reasoning process of the mind. The last class, the theme was Pratyaksha, about perception. So now, in order to introduce this subject, I'd like to give an example. That's actually an example I give in the introduction of this book. The example is of the sun, sunlight, shade, and night. So the sun, Krishna Suryasama, the sun represents Lord Krishna. The sunlight, as you've probably yourselves read in various places in Srila Prabhupada's books, the sunlight refers to the jiva, the living entities, who are, Prabhupada compares to particles of sunlight which stream forth from the great globe, great solar disk. So they have the same quality as the sun. They're brilliant. But the quantity is very, very much less. And therefore, the sunlight can be obstructed. It can be obscured. And so that brings us to shade. Just as now, you're all sitting in the shade. So that is an obscuration of light. So this shade represents subtle material energy. As you know, we have two kinds of bodies. One is called the linga sharira in Sanskrit. It means the subtle body, which is made up of ahankara, buddhi, and manas, or false ego, material intelligence, and mind. So the shade, as we are sitting under the shade now, that shade represents the subtle material energy. Means, to refer to another example I gave a few days ago, just like the example of the smoke and the fire. So shade is always associated with sunlight, but still there's a difference. Similarly, smoke is always associated with fire, but there's a difference. And as a matter of fact, smoke, as I said, it is a symptom that the fire is not burning cleanly. So the fact that we have a material mind means that we're out of Krishna consciousness. We are spirit soul. We are always eternally spirit soul. But in this present condition, we are not Krishna conscious spirit souls. And therefore our consciousness has been captured by Maya, and that actual capturing process is by way of the subtle material energy. And then finally, there is darkness, total darkness, as we see at night. So this represents the gross material energy. And we have also a body of gross material energy called the sthula sharira. Sthula sharira is the anamaya kosha. You may have heard about these koshas, it means coverings of the soul, sheath, kosha is often translated as sheath. So the anamaya means that covering which is nurtured by ana. Ana means food. So that's this gross body. And then around us is the gross material world. So now, Krishna Surya Sama, Krishna is like the sun. The light emanates from the sun, so does the shade, so does the night. All of this is produced by the sun. But the sun is independent from light, from shade, and from night, although these are effects of the sun. So similarly, the jiva, the mental platform, subtle platform, and the gross physical platform, gross matter, they all emanate from Krishna, but Krishna is independent from them. So now we want to, taking this example, we want to focus in on that which corresponds to the shade, the subtle material energy, the functions of the subtle material energy, which is anuman, or reasoning. So, now, in this talk I'm having to condense a lot of information into the space of this 1 hour, but I'll try to condense it and at the same time keep it very clear and simple. So when we speak of reasoning, we're speaking of, first of all, as I said, functions of the mind. So the mind is material energy. Everything material, as Lord Krishna explains in Bhagavad Gita, everything in this material world is a product of three modes. So similarly, there are three modes of the mind, or three modes of mental functions. So I'd like to explain them in this way. They're explained actually in different ways, sometimes thinking, feeling, willing. That's one way. But I'd like to explain it in this way, which is an explanation I gave in the book, because it will help us to understand right off the bat the limitations of the mind. So the three modes of thought are reflective thinking, creative thinking, and critical thinking. So now I'll just give you an example, and hopefully from this example what these three mean will be very clear to you. It's an example I give in the book, since we're here in the Gurukul, and this is the example from taken from this Gurukul, so it should be very, very clear. So over there on that side of the Gurukul, I have a hut, something like this one here, grass hut that I live in. So in the book I say, imagine I'm sitting in the hut writing this very book at my computer, and then I hear from outside a strange sound. Now that hearing, that's pratyaksha, as we explained the other day. But as I also explained the other day, by pratyaksha we don't see the cause, we don't see the source of our perceptions, we don't know why we have perceptions. So that is actually the beginning of speculation. Huh? Just as if I'm sitting in my hut and I hear some sound, I can't see the cause. So then I think something. So the thinking starts as reflection. Oh, I hear a sound. Reflection means the sound has come into the mind and you're surprised by it, or anyway, you find it interesting. That's the meaning of reflective thinking. Here's something interesting. This sound. What is that sound? This is also reflection. So then, because you can't see, then the mind shifts into the creative mode. The mind becomes creative. Mode of passion. It starts to invent possible answers to this question. Now, in the book, just for humor's sake, because humor people find interesting, so I propose that this sound is the sound produced, the same sound is produced by an ostrich. You know this tall bird in Africa. Now, I don't know what an ostrich sounds like. I don't even know if ostriches make sound. But just for humor's sake, I described it like that in the book. So, actually, the example is of myself and another person. This other person represents my mind. So we hear this sound, and then I ask, what could that be? And my mind says, it's a very interesting sound. Sounds just like an ostrich. Then the mind becomes creative and goes on to say, but how could it be an ostrich? Because after all, ostriches don't live in India. Of course, perhaps there was an ostrich in the Calcutta Zoo, which escaped. And somehow it ran up here and is standing outside the hut making that sound. But perhaps more likely, there's a boy, one of the boys here in the Gurukul, who's learned to make a sound just like an ostrich, and he's out there playing some joke on us. Then the mind goes on. Then the mind becomes critical. That's the third phase. The mind starts to have doubts. But how could it be a boy? Because after all, these are all Bengali boys. There are no ostriches in Bengal, so how they would learn to make this sound? So then the mind enters deeper and deeper into doubt. And finally, the mind comes to the conclusion, well, maybe this is just a dream. And then I say to the mind, well, how could it be a dream? I mean, I'm awake, you're awake. And the mind says, that doesn't mean anything. We could both be awake in a dream. And we're talking as if we're awake, but it's all a dream. And perhaps life is just like that. Perhaps life is a dream. Perhaps nothing makes any sense. So this is what happens on the mental plane. The mind goes from reflection, finding perceptions interesting, to creative thinking, trying to come up with some explanation, some reason. An explanation means a reason for why we're seeing and hearing and tasting and touching and smelling what we hear, see, taste, touch, and smell. And at the end, the mind becomes skeptical. In fact, the mind may become completely, totally skeptical and come to the conclusion, as we know, from in the West, there's a type of philosopher called the solipsist. Solipsist means, from Latin, solus means alone, ipsa, I am. So I am alone. Person thinks I am the only person existing. I'm the only mind. And everything else is just my dream. And in Indian philosophy, the Mayavadis adopt a very similar point of view. Because aham brahmasmi, I am Brahman, sarvam kalvida brahma, everything is Brahman, Brahman satya, jagan mitya, only Brahman is true, the jagat, the universe is false, my dream. So this is the end result of critical thinking. It pulls the rug out from everything, you see. And this was, I made this point the other day too. That is also where the Pratyakshavadis end up. They cannot really say, based on our reasoning, it is not certain. We can never hold it as being certain. After all, first of all, it's based on imperfect, uncertain sense perceptions. And then the functions of their mind, going through reflection, creativity, and then criticism, also ends up in uncertainty. So, then, yes, about reasoning, to give an explanation. Now this involves language. So I give in this book two theories of truth. Actually, from what I can understand, when we speak of mental speculation, speculation which leads one off the track of Krishna consciousness, it's basically just two kinds of speculation. one kind is called in the West the correspondence theory, correspondence theory of truth, and there's a corresponding Sanskrit term for it too. The Artha Sarupya or Vishaya Sarupya, which just means that the words I speak should correspond with reality, with what we perceive. I mean, that is obviously a requirement in considering what is truth. For instance, if I'm sitting here, if I come here to give this lecture, I sit down and I introduce myself as Madan Mohan Mohani Devi Dasi. So now you're immediately going to become very doubtful about because there's no Artha Sarupya, there's no correspondence. I've given the name of a lady, but I'm obviously not one. So then this immediately we start to wonder, is he telling the truth? What is going to be the value of his lecture? He's just introduced himself in a way that, which cannot be true. So this is initially in questions of truth what we look for, that there will be a basic correspondence between words and things. Now there are those, again, the pratyakshavadis, the empiricists, the so-called scientifically minded people, they want to limit truth to this. And so here we immediately get into paradoxes. Now I've detailed these paradoxes in the first chapter of my book, and I'll go over some of them now. One of the paradoxes, let's see. Oh yes, I'll read something from one philosopher. It's a very clear statement, so I think you'll understand it right off the bat. He says, if I have to describe this right hand of mine, which I am now holding up, I may say different things of it. I may state its size, its shape, its color, its tissue, the chemical compound of its bones, its cells, and perhaps add some more particulars. But however far I go, I shall never reach a point where my description will be completed. Logically speaking, it is always possible to extend the description by adding some detail or other. In other words, the appearance of things always exceeds our power to describe them. And why is that? Because this is Krishna's energy. And Krishna's energy is ultimately unlimited. And what we try to do by this correspondence, it's also there in measurement. We're actually trying to measure things by words or by numbers or by some other standard. But it's not possible. Because inherently, essentially, Krishna's energy is unlimited. I also give the example of, scientists, they talk about facts, proven facts. But these proven facts are all in terms of their measurement, which is all mental speculation ultimately. Like the so-called proven fact or law that water boils at 100 degrees centigrade. Now what is that? What is that actually saying? First of all, you take water in a closed vessel, closed vessel with a top on it. It does not boil at 100 degrees centigrade. Water boiled at high altitude also does not boil at 100 degrees centigrade. Also, even you take water in an open vessel at sea level and boil it in different vessels with different thermometers in the different vessels, you will find that one thermometer, as the water starts to boil, says 99 degrees, another thermometer says 97 degrees, another says 101 degrees, another says 104 degrees. This is a proven, this is well known. So these attempts to pin things down with names or numbers. This is actually Maya, Nama Rupa. This is stated in the Bhagavatam and other Vedic literatures, that this material world, this world of illusion, is a big assembly of Nama Rupa, names and forms, which are always shifting, which are always in flux. And if one thinks that he has pinned down reality by giving it a name or a number, he's a fool. This again, this is the uncertain, unsteady mental platform. It is actually trying to understand this world out here in terms of our own duality, in terms of our own limitations. And it becomes a big, you know, this correspondence theory of the truth is just, it's a so-called philosophical principle which actually has no substance, ultimately. Of course, it's again, there must be some correspondence that we admit, but the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth cannot be limited to correspondence. So this is one point. Then, going beyond correspondence, then there's another theory, the coherence theory of the truth. The coherence theory of the truth does not consider the form of things to be the final reality. It's accepted. Yes, this is only, as I said the other day, just impressions. But there is some metaphysical construct, some subtle construct, which supposedly explains all this that we're perceiving. It's a metaphysical theory. And how do we know, how can we tell if we can't perceive it, that this theory is, such a theory would be true or not? It's the coherence. In other words, it all has to fit together very nicely, explaining everything, being very logical within itself. So now, the problem with this correspondence is that because it is based on our own sense perception and our own mind, it must come to an ultimate limit. And that limit you find in philosophy, whether Eastern philosophy, Indian philosophy, or also Western philosophy. The ultimate limit is existence itself. In other words, by this logic, by this higher meaning of things, they end up negating the things that we see. This is not really a tree. It's some, you know, higher metaphysical principle. You see? And finally, this attempt is to explain existence itself. So then they have to distinguish existence from all the things that we know through the senses, all the things in time, because existence is timeless. And so this is negation. So this the ultimate correspondence comes to monism, from the many to the one. And what is that one? If you take away the many, then it has no form, it has no quality, it has no color, it has no activity, nothing. So therefore, I read a quote from a philosopher who is speaking about existence, and he says, ultimately, being is non-being. You see, being or existence itself is that which has no qualities at all, because all the qualities that we can speak of, they're produced in time, they're maintained in time, and they're destroyed by time. So, then this conclusion that everything is nothing or being is non-being, that's the ultimate limit of this so-called coherence theory. So these are the two directions in which we can speculate. Correspondence and coherence. And this also you'll find in the Vedic philosophy too, karma vada, jnana vada. Srila Prabhupada in the Upadeshamrita, in one purport, he speaks of these two as being deviations from the actual path, which is bhakti. So this is another yes, evidence of the fallible nature of the mind. So then how are we to use the mind? How is devotees are we to use the mind? So Srila Prabhupada, he explains that we have a process of knowledge or process of logic. Logic means anuman, a way of thinking. And so our process of logic is deductive. Deductive in Sanskrit is the avaroha, descending process. It depends on authority. Now it is not blind following, and I'll give the example I gave from the book. Going back to my being in the hut and hearing a strange sound. Now I can't determine what that sound is by my mental speculation. I can think maybe it's an ostrich, or maybe it's a boy, or maybe it's a dream, or who knows, my mental speculation. I can think maybe it's an ostrich, or maybe it's a boy, or maybe it's a dream, or who knows what. There's any possibility of speculations. And that is admitted by scientists and philosophers today, that there's no limit of speculation that one can come up with to explain the things that we perceive. Just like in science, there's two very famous, completely contradictory theories. The physics of Sir Isaac Newton and the physics of Albert Einstein. Now, both of them explain what we perceive, but they're very, very opposite. They do not fit together at all well. Although somehow scientists, they accommodate them both. And the scientists admit there could be any number of other speculations that might explain the things that we see. So you can never be sure. So, therefore, coming back to this example of myself being in the hut and wondering what the sound is outside. So if Bhakti Vidyapurna Swami comes in, he's in charge of the academy over there. So if he walks in my hut, then I can ask him, Maharaj, what is that strange sound outside? Now he's just come from outside. He knows all the boys, he knows what goes on in the Gurukul. So because he knows and he's just come from outside, then I can accept his explanation as being the truth. He'll say, oh, it's some boy from South Africa where they have ostriches. He's a student. And he makes this sound as a joke. So this is the deductive process. And Srila Prabhupada said this is the process that we use in Krishna consciousness. Now, the deductive process, it can be, to use a Sanskrit term, laukika. It can also be simply ordinary, simply based on some ordinary man's speculation too. I gave before the example of Aristotle, who is considered the philosopher. They called him the philosopher in Europe. And everything Aristotle said for centuries was considered true by these Christian scholastic philosophers in the Middle Ages. They all worshipped Aristotle. But then some more doubting intellectuals, they started to find some discrepancies in Aristotle's writings. And one of them was that women have less teeth than men. So empirically, if you count the teeth in a woman's mouth and in a man's mouth, you find that's the same number. So this seed of doubt began to grow, and they began to wonder. You know, Aristotle's talking so many metaphysical principles which we can't verify. And when we look at the things that we can verify, like the number of teeth in a person's mouth, we find they're wrong. So why should we accept his ideas of form, being and becoming, and matter and soul, and so on and so forth? These higher ideas, when he even gets the number of teeth in a woman's mouth wrong. So therefore, wholesale, they rejected Aristotle. So this is an example of laukika deduction, to accept blindly an ordinary man's speculation. So then, how can we avoid that? Well, of course, we have our process, Guru Shastra Sadhu, Guru Parampara. There's also another process of logic which will help us, and that Prabhupada called philosophical speculation as opposed to mental speculation. And he gave the example of, very simple example, where Lord Krishna says, I am the taste of water. So what does that mean? Now if one speculates on his own, in his own independent manner, then he may think that Krishna is saying, I am water. That's all Krishna is. He's just water. And so these foolish devotees, they're just worshipping water. Actually, you'll find that when Western scholars criticize the Vedic doctrine, the Vedic religion, they often come to such kind of a conclusion, like about the deities. You're just worshipping some metal or stone statue. They don't understand, as we find in the Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita, that what is actually at work here is a principle called Sakya Chandra Nyaya. It's the example of the rising of the moon seen through the branches of a tree. Now the branches of the tree represent our own perception and our own thoughts. The moon, Chandra, Krishna Chandra, that is Krishna, that is the absolute truth. So the moon has revealed himself there. The moon has risen there, behind this tree. Now, the teacher wants to point out to the student, there's the moon. So he points, look at that tree, and there you will see the moon. So the student looks. Now, the example is, you're looking through your senses, you're looking through your mind. But you're seeing something beyond the mind and senses. Huh? Which is the way Lord Krishna reveals himself to us by his mercy in this world. Now, when we see the moon in the branches, we should not think that, oh, someone has thrown a glowing rubber beach ball, white rubber beach ball, into the branches of the tree and it's become stuck there. Just see, isn't that interesting? No, that's the moon is not held fast by the branches of the tree. If you keep watching, you'll see the moon rise higher and higher outside of the tree into the sky. The moon is millions and millions of times bigger than that tree. But Lord Krishna, out of his mercy, he reveals himself in such a way that we can get a fix on him through our own mind and senses. So this is what Srila Prabhupada called philosophical speculation. Lord Krishna is giving the hint how he can be understood even by us in this conditioned state. Take a glass of water, drink it, and remember that Lord Krishna has said, I am that taste. And you think about it. You speculate. This kind of speculation is approved. Srila Prabhupada encouraged that we should speculate in this way, along the lines of Shastra, again, Shastra Shakshush. Because this type of speculation is pleasing to Krishna. And thus Krishna reveals himself. So these are our two processes. There's a process of receiving knowledge by way of Guru Parampara. Getting, Srila Prabhupada says, don't accept blindly, we should ask questions, we should ask the spiritual master, just as I said, if Bhaktivedanta Swami comes in my hut, I can ask him any question I want about why that sound, why I'm hearing that sound, he'll answer it. And then, besides simply receiving the knowledge, then there's applying what we have learned from the spiritual master, according, again, to the direction of the Lord. When you taste water, you remember Krishna. When you see the deity, you remember this is Krishna. Krishna appearing in this way. The holy name, same thing. The holy name is not an ordinary mundane sound. And so by doing this, by this application or philosophical speculation, one comes to realization. The Lord is pleased The Lord is actually pleased that we are trying to understand Him in this approved way. And He reveals more and more of Himself. In this way, a devotee becomes wise. A devotee becomes realized. He actually sees deeper and deeper and deeper into the absolute truth by his own experience. Then there's another kind of logic, which we also use. But this is not the logic that we use in order to understand the absolute truth. This is practical, pragmatic logic. It's called induction. Arohapanta. I'll give an example. In the very beginning days of ISKCON, Srila Prabhupada sent one of his disciples, actually a Satsvarupa, at that time Satsvarupa Das, Satsvarupa Prabhu. He sent him to the IBM company because IBM had advertised that they would give a free top-range typewriter to charitable non-profit organizations, welfare organizations, which are doing good for society. So Srila Prabhupada said to Satsvarupa, so our movement is the highest welfare movement, doing the highest welfare work, so they should certainly give the typewriter to ISKCON. So please go there and explain what we are doing and see if they will give a typewriter. So Satsvarupa Prabhu went there and he made his presentation, but it was not accepted at all. Because ISKCON at that time was practically unknown. And of course, you know, devotees at that time, shaved head, tilak, were also practically unseen. It was a very surprising sight. So IBM refused to give. So this is an example of how we use the inductive process. Induction means that you're not certain whether something is going to happen or whether something is as it seems to be. But you make a test. It's testing. It's the same process that the police use when they're investigating a crime. They add up the evidence and they think, well, there's a chance, say if it's a murder case in some rich home, there seems to be a good chance that the butler did it. They don't know for sure, but they make tests. They interview the butler, they take his fingerprints, they trace his movements. And if all the evidence seems to support this theory, then they'll charge the butler with the crime. Then actually it's a hypothesis first, and then it becomes a theory. Theory means it's a pretty good guess. There's a lot of proof to support it. But we never really know for sure. You see, even in such kinds of criminal cases, there have been famous instances, well known, that someone is charged with a crime, he's brought to the trial, he's convicted, because all the evidence adds up that he did it. Then 10 years later, after he's rotted in the penitentiary for a decade, they find out who really did it. And then with red faces, they have to let the poor man go. Oh, we're very sorry. We made a mistake. So that is the inductive process. Srila Prabhupada said, based on our imperfect sense perception and imperfect understanding of things, we try to generalize, we try to leap, make a leap into the unknown, guess what it all means. So now that's all right for practical things like going to see if IBM will give us a computer or not. It's also a kind of gamble. Prabhupada said we should take a risk in preaching. Prabhupada said, hunt for the rhinoceros. He said, if you're going to go hunting, then hunt for the rhinoceros. Because if you don't get the rhinoceros, then people will say, anyway, rhinoceros, so difficult. Nobody can shoot the rhinoceros, so difficult. And if you do get it, everyone will say, oh, how wonderful. But that is only in practical affairs. So the mistake of all the mundane philosophers, scientists, thinkers, so on, is that they use this laukika, it means ordinary, inductive process for trying to achieve the absolute truth. They take some evidence from their senses, they run it through their limited logic, and then they come to some big conclusion, some big theory. I give a simple example here. It's actually taken from a textbook just to explain what is this inductive logic. That what is it? You can the example I give is you go into a storeroom where they're keeping grains and beans and so on, foodstuffs. And as you're going in, someone comes out. They're holding something in their hand. And they say, they tell you, these beans that I have in my hand, they're from that bag. You see in the corner, there's a bag. And they open their hand and show you, these beans are white. And then they leave. So now you can speculate. Perhaps this means that all the beans in that bag are white. But you really don't know for sure. Perhaps they're mixed beans. There's white, there's red, there's black beans. And this person was picking them out, and that's why she's leaving with the beans held in her hand, because she had to pick them out. So that may be true. You don't really know for sure until you look in the bag and see that these beans are white or multicolored or whatever. You don't really know for sure, just because she has said, these beans are from that bag and these beans are white. So now, if you can look in the bag and see that they're all white, alright, so then that was perfect induction. But if the bean is metaphysical, if it's beyond your power to see, then you have no right to draw such a conclusion. But that's what the mundane speculators do. So, all these theories, just like today, they're working on what they call a theory of everything. A big physicist and scientist, based upon what they perceive here, they're trying to come up with a theory of everything, a theory explaining the whole universe. They have no right to do that, because our perception, our logic is limited and uncertain. But as I explained the other day, that is their enterprise. That is what mundane knowledge means. It's simply a kind of business that you just go on speculating, keeping everything uncertain. Ultimately, they will all admit, yes, we really don't know. We really don't know if anything, any of our scientific theories are true. They say actually a scientific theory can never be proved. It can only be disproved. And yet you have to learn all this in school. You see, this is the tragic irony. Ultimately, when you push these people, is there any truth? Can you really say that what you believe, this theory of evolution or quantum physics theory or whatever it may be, is true? They will admit, no, we cannot actually say that it's true. We think it is probable, that's all. So it's just a guess. Probability means a guess. It's like when you play dice, you roll a dice, you think, now 3 will come up. So there's a 1 out of 6 probability that you'll be right. It's just gambling. Mental speculation and gambling. You see, one of the regulative principles that we're not supposed to break. But that's their process. And they're very happy with it. They're very happy with it that ultimately, although of course, in the university they will present Darwin's theory as an, you know, a very, very scientific fact. There's no doubt about it. We have no doubt about it. This is the way it happened. But if you push them, they have to admit philosophically, actually, we're not certain. But that's good, because that allows us to go on speculating and speculating and speculating. It allows for later on some other scientist coming along and putting forward an argument, a theory, which defeats Darwin or Einstein. which will have to happen, because no theory stands for very long. Max Planck, one of the very famous scientists, he said, actually, theories change with the generations. He said, basically, the way theories change, it has nothing to do with this or that fact being discovered. It's simply that the next generation of scientists, they grow tired of the previous generation's theories, and they start to think of new things. And this is how, this is the so-called progress of science. Of course, someone may say, but out of these theories there are results. You know, it's not just airy-fairy speculation, the wild, insane hallucinations that become accepted. There has to be some results. Some, as I said, some type of perfection some technological advancement or whatever. So what is that? That is Maya. That is Maya. Maya, that's Maya Devi's business. Srila Prabhupada says Maya has two shaktis, throwing and dragging. So she throws us into illusion, and she drags us deeper and deeper and deeper into illusion. You see, as one is thrown into illusion, then one may start to seeing, as we've been explaining, that my perceptions are illusion. So let me cogitate, let me speculate about some truth beyond this illusion. And as soon as one starts to do that, Maya grabs hold and drags you deeper and deeper and deeper into illusion. And that dragging entails also that there is apparent confirmation of our speculation. Apparently, Einstein's theory of relativity is right because of certain experimental results. Or apparently, Darwin's theory of evolution is right because of they dug up some bones or something like that. And then people become very convinced, yes, yes. But this is just Maya. Maya Devi herself providing so-called proofs. But ultimately, because Maya Devi's business is not to reward us, it is to punish us. So ultimately, all these big scientists and their theories, she drops them by the wayside of history. She drops them in the trash can of history and puts the lid on them. They fade away into forgetfulness. It's like this Western science, as I said before. It can be traced back to the ancient Greeks. And you read the ancient Greek philosophers, and their science, what was known as science in those days. If we read these theories now, we'll just laugh. How ridiculous. How could they imagine? But in those days, they were the big learned men. They were the sages. Huh? Everyone was learning and memorizing what they had to say and teaching their disciples. So ultimately, this mind has been given to be used in a certain prescribed way. And this is yajna. Lord Krishna speaks in Bhagavad Gita of different kinds of yajna. One is dravya yajna, to use material things in sacrifice to the Lord. Another kind of yajna is jnana yajna, to use our knowledge in sacrifice to the Lord. So we've been given this capacity to know things. We've been given a capacity to speculate. As I said, the three modes of thought are there to reflect, to think creatively, and to criticize. We should use these in Krishna's service. Huh? And by using material things, whether gross or subtle, in Krishna's service, they are purified. Actually, it's interesting, the word yajna in Sanskrit is a name of Krishna. So one realizes Krishna through yajna. Also, the English word sacrifice comes from a Latin term, which means to make sacred, to make a thing holy. So when a thing is used in Krishna's service, including the mind, including the intelligence, including even speculation, it becomes holy, it becomes sanctified. simply because we're using it as Guru and Krishna directs. Huh? We're using the body, the mind, the words as instruments in the Lord's service. And therefore the Lord becomes pleased with his devotee. And he manifests himself within that devotee's body, mind, and words, and deeds. So I think I would like to stop here. I'm a little hoarse. I have a sore throat and a bit of bronchitis. What time is it now? 12 o'clock, okay. That's anyway time. Is there any questions? Yes?
Authority is the way to understand absolute truth, but we can see in all over the world there are so many different authorities. When they speak, they have their followers who are very convinced. So what's the way to find proper authority?
And so his question is that our process is to hear from authority, but we can see around the world there are different authorities. Maybe, I suppose you mean, they may be saying different things. But each has their followers who are very convinced. So how do we know which authority is actually the true authority? So that question was asked by Srila Prabhupada by John Lennon in 1969. So how do we know who is the real guru? Because at that time, as now also, there were so many gurus and swamis coming out of India, supposedly teaching Bhagavad Gita. Prabhupada presented Bhagavad Gita as it is. There was another swami who presented, after that, he presented a Bhagavad Gita as it was. And Prabhupada used to jokingly speak about Bhagavad Gita as we are. So there's different versions of Bhagavad Gita. So how do we know which is right? So Srila Prabhupada answered John Lennon's question, that you must find that guru who is, that spiritual master who is most addicted to Krishna. This is a kind of ironic statement, because at that time John Lennon was becoming addicted to heroin. So Prabhupada, in a pointed way, he made this remark. You must find he who is most addicted to Krishna. So Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, in his Shikshashtakam prayers, has described this state of addiction to Krishna, especially with the culmination in the last of the eight verses. Ashlishava padaratam panashtumam adarshanam mam. So I may see you or I may not see you, but still you remain the Lord of my life. In other words, one remains fixed in devotional service under any circumstances. It is not that one serves Krishna for some material result and then after having received it, then gives up the worship. But in good times or bad, in honor or dishonor, any state, one remains fixed at the lotus feet of the Lord. And to be addicted to Krishna, just like when one is addicted to drugs or addicted to anything, then that means the body, the mind, as we're saying, body, mind, words, every aspect of our being is focused on that one thing. So one who is an actual bona fide representative of Lord Krishna, the body is fixed in Krishna's service. You won't find any taint of material activities, either gross or subtle. The mind is fixed in Krishna's service. The words, he's only speaking of Krishna. And another important point is that, as Lord Krishna himself says in the Bhagavad Gita, actually this is another way to get an answer to your question, because in the famous verse in the fourth chapter, the Lord says we should accept a spiritual master. Tadvidi, if you want this knowledge, then pranipatena pariprasnena sevya, then you accept the spiritual master. Then in the next verse, he actually explains what are the symptoms of one who has got that knowledge. And he says that when one is no longer bewildered, but who sees every living entity as part and parcel of me, then that person, he is situated in transcendental knowledge. So, to be no longer bewildered means to see every living entity as spirit soul. And Srila Prabhupada said, that means in turn, working for their spiritual welfare. Because these living entities, they are spirit soul. We may see that, but they do not see them. They're steeped in ignorance. They're sinking down into illusion. So one who actually sees the true identity of all living entities, then he will invest all of his energy, all of his intelligence, in trying to help these living entities by preaching, by uplifting them. And Srila Prabhupada therefore said, one can know spiritual master by his disciples. See, if a spiritual master's disciples, if they are saved, if they are above the influence of the material energy, then that is the proof of the potency of his teachings. If one sees someone, he's supposedly a spiritual master, but his disciples are all addicted to material habits still, sinful activities, then where is the potency? Yes?
But then the noble person might say that, you know, why do you think that this is criteria that he should be very addicted to Krishna? Maybe real guru is person who is very addicted to impersonal Brahman. Maybe we should judge according to that criteria, that person might ask.
Yeah, well, again, then this means you're just making up your own standards. And this is the speculation of coherence and correspondence. It simply means you're making up your own correspondence. You're saying, this is like this, and coherence. You're saying, this makes sense to me. And that is the truth. But who gave you the right to do that? See, Srila Prabhupada said, then if that's a fact, if you just want to declare your own philosophy, then do that. Then you write your own Gita. You see, you compose your own scriptures. You know, just make sure, just be honest, make sure that all these ideas are coming from you. Srila Prabhupada said, but no, what they do is because, as Prabhupada said, Krishna is a big gun. Meaning that Krishna is very famous in spiritual circles. So therefore, they want to speak all their own nonsense, but blame it on Krishna. They want to tie it into the Bhagavad Gita. Prabhupada said, this is like smoking marijuana using another person's hand. Take another person's hand, put the marijuana cigarette there, and you smoke. So the stain of the marijuana will go on his fingers, so when the police come, he'll be arrested. So this is what they do. They have their own philosophy. But they will, by word juggling or whatever, try to say, and Krishna has also said this. But no. One who knows Bhagavad Gita as it is, knows that impersonal Brahman. And this, you know, I mean, even you read mundane scholars, even you read Mayavadis themselves, they admit this. They admit you can't defend Advaita Vedanta from Bhagavad Gita. They admit that. Some of them have tried. There was a man from Austria, from Vienna, who went to India in the 60s to become a Mayavadi sannyasi. So he went to some Advaita ashram in South India. He'd already read a lot about Advaita Vedanta, so he went to become officially trained and ordained as a Mayavadi sannyasi of the Bharati Sampradaya. So he, in the Mayavadi school, you have to learn three things. You get trained in Upanishads, in Vedanta Sutra, and in Bhagavad Gita. This was established by Shankaracharya himself. So he was reading these, and he began to see a conflict between Bhagavad Gita and the impersonal Upanishads. There are certain Upanishads which are very impersonal, and others which are personal. But he was seeing that, very clearly, that Bhagavad Gita, this is not impersonal. There's no way. You can maybe try to argue that it is, but actually it isn't. And so he brought this up to his guru, his sannyas guru, that why do we waste our time reading this Bhagavad Gita? This is not a Advaita philosophy. And his guru said, what can we do? The Bhasyakar, meaning Shankaracharya, he has told us we must read Bhagavad Gita, so therefore we read it. Now actually Shankaracharya, he is a devotee of the Lord. And his business was to cheat the atheists. But he still had their welfare in mind. Established it even for the Mayavadis, so then later on the Vaishnavacharyas, they could give the real purport of Bhagavad Gita, and no one could then say, well, Bhagavad Gita anyway. Because Shankaracharya himself said, no, Bhagavad Gita is bona fide Shastra. One other question, yes?
How did my mother philosopher supposed to accelerate the increase of population and economic?
His question is, how was the Mayavadi philosophy supposed to increase the unwanted population? It is unwanted population. Varna Shankara. And that's because the Mayavadi philosophy, it negates the senses of the Absolute of Krishna, and therefore it leaves our senses with no spiritual engagement, because our senses are designed to serve Krishna's senses. But when you say God has no senses, then you leave the human senses with nothing spiritual to do. So the Mayavadi process is to try to achieve transcendence by suppressing the senses, and that won't work. Lord Krishna himself declares in Bhagavad Gita that is not possible. So, therefore, restraining the senses agitates the mind more and more. Saying that the Lord has no senses means that these senses are anyway just illusion. So ultimately, it doesn't really matter what you do with the senses, since they're just maya. And this is the other side of the impersonal philosophy. You find there are some impersonalists, not too many anymore, but previously there used to be impersonalists who were, at least they were very strict tyagis. At least they used to say, yes, if you want to realize the impersonal Brahman, then you have to stop sense activity completely. You have to be as renounced as possible. Don't engage in any kind of sense gratification. But as Kali Yuga progresses, people are weaker and weaker. They cannot do this. They cannot hold the senses in check even for a few minutes. So now the more popular gurus coming out today are ones who say that, like there was one guru whose slogan was, Samboga Se Samadhi, which means you can have samadhi through sex. Sex life. Because what's the difference? If the senses are maya, if the mind is maya, then what is the difference if you're sitting in some rigid yoga posture or you're having sex? What's the difference? Both are just illusion. So it's all a question of, you know, your consciousness. If you're thinking, I am God, either while sitting as yogi or having illicit sex life, then you're God. What is the purpose of the spread of Mayavadi philosophy in the plan of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu? Mayavadi philosophy is destructive. So, by the spread of Mayavadi philosophy, then actually intelligence is destroyed. All previous systems of culture and philosophy are destroyed. That is the progress of Kali Yuga. So Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he comes to establish the real culture, the real philosophy. And in Kali Yuga, there's nothing that can oppose it. There's in any case nothing that can oppose it. But in Kali Yuga, everything else is deteriorated. Because this Mayavadi philosophy, it is destructive. Hoya Sarvanash, Mayavadi Basya Hoya Sarvanash, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has said, if you accept this Mayavadi philosophy, then you're doomed. So it's one or the other. Either be doomed or chant Hare Krishna. Alright, so I want to... Alright, last question. Yes, Prabhu. That's a good point. Intuition in Sanskrit is svabhav. Srila Prabhupada said svabhava, or it can be translated as your nature, your conditioned nature itself. It is comprised of habits that we have built up over many, many lifetimes. It's kind of like the subtle fingerprint of our material consciousness. So ultimately, this intuition, as Prabhupada himself explained, is the Lord in the heart reminding us of our desires, of the desires that we've cultivated. Even in this lifetime, He reminds us of activities, of unfulfilled wants from previous lifetimes. And again, so we take up in this lifetime the same effort to try to fulfill them. And this carries on life after life after life. And ultimately it is said there are two kinds of svabhav, the pious and impious, or divine and demoniac, two kinds of natures. So, if this intuition, it appears in modern philosophy, and they deal with it in different ways. Some forms of philosophy depend completely on intuition. They're very intuition-oriented. As you've pointed out, today, more likely materialistic people are analytical. And they explain this intuition in a way as materialistic as they can. That, it resembles, there's some resemblance actually to the Vedic explanation, in that, for instance, they'll analyze human being in terms of the animals, you know, and say that we are the product of evolution, and so all our human impulses can be traced back to, even one, this Carl Sagan, he spoke of a region of the human brain which is reptilian, where all the reptile functions are found. Anyway, there's some resemblance there, but Prabhupada said that ultimately this svabhava, ultimately it comes down to attraction, like attraction between male and female, sexual attraction. And where does that actually come from? Srila Prabhupada said the attraction between the soul and Krishna, or Radha and Krishna, the devotees of the Lord, and this original spiritual adirasa, this original spiritual attraction, spiritual love, that is the actual svabhav. And then in this material world, that svabhav is perverted by material nature. Okay? All right, last question. So he said, I mentioned philosophical speculation, but is there any need to speculate in such a way? Well, God has given us this mind. In other words, the capacity for speculation, for anuman, is there. It's inherent in us. And there's an old saying, use it or lose it. We should use bhakti, devotional service, means to use everything that we've received from the Lord in Krishna's service. Now, some people may be, by their nature, very simple, very even, so to speak, naive. They may not be speculative. So fine. Actually, that makes it easier. Just worship Krishna, chant the holy name, love Krishna, serve Krishna, go back home, back to Godhead. But if you have such kind of mind, inquiring mind, as I said, reflective, creative, critical mind, then it has to be made, there's a Sanskrit word, dhamma. Dhamma, which means, actually we get our English word, tame. It has to be tamed. It has to be controlled. It has to be engaged properly. And so, therefore, we should follow the instructions of Shastra, even in terms of our mental functions. So you should, if you have the capacity, you should reflect, you should think creatively, you should be critical, but all in accordance with Guru Shastra Sadhu, and that will purify the mind. If you just leave the mind to its own ways, then as Krishna says, the mind will become the worst enemy. Mind is more difficult to control than the wind. Alright, Srila Prabhupada ki jai.